tonight's talk is about thought-based reality and sense-based reality. But before I start, I want to give a few suggestions on how to listen to a Dharma talk. So a few ideas that will support you in listening and in relaxing during a Dharma talk. So first of all, know what's for you. So we give, this also holds for the instructions in the morning, we give a lot of information. And some of it may pertain to your practice and some of it may not. And so don't let some of the things we say kind of head you in an unhealthy direction. So for example, if we're talking in the morning about continuity and making all the sittings, and you already know from discussing with your teacher that it's better for you to actually moderate your practice a little more, not go to all the sittings. Don't let the instructions in the hall send you in a direction that's not helpful. The second thing is, it can be helpful if you have a kind of receptive energy around listening to the talk. And so the difference would be like a university lecture, for example. You might be thinking about what the person is saying and seeing if you agree or don't agree, and maybe analyzing and thinking and listening in that way. For a Dharma talk, we're suggesting that it's more just receiving the words, receiving what is said, and keeping it simple in your own mind as much as you can. And you don't have to agree with us. You might not, but keeping it just simple and receptive. A third suggestion is notice what resonates with you. So we'll be up here talking, and sometimes we'll say something and there'll be like a resonance within. There'll be like, oh yeah, yes. Like that is usually something that's helpful for your practice. So you can note that. The fourth thing is sometimes it's helpful to check in with the body periodically, just grounding and feeling the breath or the body sitting. And lastly, let it all go. So you don't have to worry about remembering everything we said or capturing everything we said or understanding everything we said. If you want to review it later, most of the talks will be on the web when you leave here. You can review it. But at the end of the talk, there's kind of an art to letting it go. So recently I read the description for this retreat. Sometimes I like to do that. I like to read what we say the retreat's going to be about and see if we're actually doing it. And so the last sentence of the description for the three-month course is, this silent retreat will encourage a balanced attitude of relaxation and alertness and the continuity of practice based on the Buddha's four foundations of mindfulness. Great. I was planning to talk about the four foundations of mindfulness. So there, we are making sure that we're covering what we said we would cover. I will just be speaking about just a small part of the teachings of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Whole books have been written, and I'm sure even series of books have been written on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, so we're not going to cover it all tonight, but we will all be talking about them at different times during the retreat, because they're really the foundation of this type of practice, of Vipassana practice, of insight practice, and the way that it's taught here. So the four foundations of mindfulness, known in Pali as the Satipatthana Sutra, are four areas, you could say, of investigation in our Vipassana practice. Or there are four places. You could say places are experiences to pay attention to in order to develop this kind of understanding that frees the heart and the mind. And I think of the four of them like a prescription for meditation. So briefly, the four are, the first foundation is the body. The second foundation is feeling tone or the affective quality of each moment as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The third one is the mind. And the fourth one is translated in so many different ways. The way I look at it is the understanding of causality. So a certain kind of mindfulness of wisdom. Mindfulness of causality. The reason for you Buddhist geeks out there, the reason I look at the fourth foundation that way is in many of the early Buddhist versions of the Satipatthana Sutra, this fourth foundation includes like all of the teachings of the Buddha, the four noble truths, the aggregates, the sense bases, hindrances, the factors of awakening. But in scholarly research that's been done, particularly by Bhikkhu Anālio, he found that in different versions of the Satipatthana Sutra in different lineages, that there were only two parts of that last foundation that overlapped in all of them, and that was the hindrances and the factors of awakening. And that makes total sense to me because it follows from the third foundation, the mind. And so I love the way the four of them work together. So there's this body we have, right? And we come into our sense experience, and then we notice that there's this affective quality of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then we notice what the mind does with that. And then we start to understand the conditioning of the mind and how we can work with it so that there's more wholesomeness and less unwholesomeness. So they kind of all work together. I used to think of them as separate, and now I see they come together very nicely. So they give us a way to organize our meditation. The mind's kind of messy, if you haven't noticed that yet, you're not paying attention. The mind is kind of wild and messy, and it's really helpful to have some kind of plan and some kind of pointers that help us figure out how to pay attention and where to pay attention in ways that will free the mind. So that's what the four foundations do. What is mindfulness? We could spend a long time talking about just that question. Every once in a while, we get this idea as teachers that we're all going to give a mindfulness talk the first week, each one of us. But we haven't done it yet. Maybe we will, because each of us would like bring out different aspects or facets of mindfulness. It's a many-faceted jewel. So I'll bring out a few facets right now that I like to emphasize with mindfulness. As I believe it was Winnie said, the root of mindfulness is to remember. And perhaps we could think of it as remembering to wake up, right? We're lost in some kind of thought, and then we remember where we are and what we're doing. I think of mindfulness as a kind of intimacy with experience. It's a getting close to experience, getting intimate with what is happening so that we can know its true nature. Suzuki Roshi calls mindfulness a soft readiness. Soft. Perhaps there's that willingness for this intimacy, this closeness to life. Readiness has a sense of alertness, yet not with an agenda, but more receptive. A soft gaze. Often we approach our practice, I think, a little bit like hunters. We're like, oh, I'm going to nab that moment. I'm going to go out and get it. And there's this sometimes a little bit too much energy, you could say, going after what? The present moment? After it. I'm going to suggest that rather being like hunters, that we consider being more like farmers. So we tend the soil. We take care of the soil. We plant seeds of mindfulness. We plant seeds of wisdom. We plant seeds of compassion. We water them. And then we let them sprout in their own time. So there's a kind of trust there, and a gentleness and a patience. Sometimes it doesn't seem like anything's happening, but yet if we keep taking care of the soil and keep nurturing the conditions, things grow. So a kind of receptive and alert presence that has the quality of intimacy. There's a way that I like to describe this through the teachings of an African-American, George Washington Carver, who was born a slave in this country in 1964, and then as a free man, he had this genius for working with plants. He was known as quite a healer. And at one point somebody asked him, well, how did you learn what you know? And he says, all the flowers talk to me, and so do hundreds of living things in the woods. I learn what I know by watching and loving everything. I learn what I know by watching and loving everything. It feels so intimate. So perhaps the intimacy in this quality of mindfulness has a flavor of love, or a flavor of kindness. It's said that each moment of pure mindfulness is a moment also of non-aversion, sometimes translated as metta. So non-aggression, perhaps, thinking of mindfulness as non-aggression. Watching and loving everything that arises. Bhante Gujarati says that there's a related word to mindfulness, aparnada, which means the absence of madness. I like that as a prescription for mindfulness too. The presence that we experience with mindfulness gives us this opportunity for a sane and sensible response to the world, or a sane and sensible relationship with the world. So the first foundation of mindfulness is the body. And interestingly, this foundation in the Satipatthana Sutra gets more pages by a long shot than any of the other foundations. Like the second foundation is maybe half a page, and the first foundation on body is, can't remember exactly, but I think it's 8 or 9 pages. And it goes through a lot of different ways of connecting with the body, understanding the body, becoming intimate with the body, from breath meditation to posture, knowing what posture we're in, to full awareness of all of our movements throughout the day, parts of the body, the elemental nature of the body, death meditation, corpse meditation, covering the full gamut. So at different times, we'll be talking about different aspects of this foundation of the body. Tonight, I'm not going to directly talk about those different types, but more talk about this foundation of the body as the five sense experiences and how we use our sense experience as a touchstone into the present moment or as the present moment, and as a touchstone for cultivating the kind of wisdom or the kind of insight that leads to freedom. And so I want to contrast this with thought-based reality. So the sense-based reality of our bodies, contrasting with the thought-created reality of the mind. The Buddha said in the Dhammapada, "They awaken, always wide awake, Gotama's disciples, whose mindfulness both day and night is constantly immersed in the body." It's a nice aspiration, this constant immersion in the body. But what most of us notice pretty early on in our practice is that a lot of our reality is thinking, is in the thought-created worlds of the mind. So it's really important that we understand these worlds. We understand thought. We want to get to know it. We want to get intimate with that too. We want to learn how to relate to thoughts in a way that is onward leading, leads towards freedom. Huge part of our reality. So I'd like to talk a little bit about thoughts with an article that I found by somebody named Kim Boykin, and it's called Meditation Hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. So what she did is one time she was camping in Colorado in the Rocky Mountain National Park, and she picked up a pamphlet that was about living in bear country and what to do if you meet a bear. So she wound up substituting the word thought for bear and came up with these helpful hints. What to do if you meet a thought. Colorado has been home to thought since their earliest ancestors evolved in North America. Today, increasing numbers of people routinely live and play in thought country. Learning about thoughts and being aware of their habits will help you fully appreciate these unique animals and the habitat in which they live. What to do if you meet a thought? There are no definite rules about what to do if you meet a thought. Thought attacks are rare compared to the number of close encounters. However, if you do meet a thought before it has time to leave an area, here are some suggestions. Remember, every situation is different with respect to the thought, the terrain, the people, and their activity. Stay calm. If you see a thought and it hasn't seen you, calmly leave the area. Stop. Back away slowly while facing the thought. Give the thought plenty of room to escape. Wild thoughts rarely attack people unless they feel threatened or provoked. Speak softly. This may reassure the thought that no harm is meant to it. If a thought stands upright or moves closer, it may be trying to detect smells in the air. This isn't a sign of aggression. Once a thought identifies you, it may leave the area or try to intimidate you by charging to within a few feet before it withdraws. Don't run or make any sudden movements. Running is likely to prompt the thought to give chase, and you can't outrun a thought. If you have a potentially life-threatening situation with a thought or an injury occurs, please pick up the red phone in the office. There's some good wisdom in here. It's basically give thoughts plenty of space, and if you don't bother them, they're not going to bother you, right? And if they start to get really aggressive, then it's good to do something, set some limits with the thoughts. But maybe it's helpful to think of thoughts as wild animals, that they are kind of wild animals, and that we treat them with respect and basically give them lots of space. It would be helpful if somebody taught us early on that we don't have to believe our thoughts. That's a big part of the challenge of working with thoughts, is that we so believe these thought-created worlds. So we live in thought-created reality, and then we believe these realities that we fabricate. It's all made up, you know. I like to look out when I'm traveling for good Dharma in the magazines. And maybe I didn't bring it, but I think I remember it. Oh yeah, so in my last travels, one of the airline magazines, there was a ad, I think it was Maybelline or something, and they had this beautiful model with glossy lip gloss, selling lip gloss. And underneath it said, "I am what I make up." I thought, that's pretty good Dharma. I don't think they meant it like I was thinking. But what we see is that we make it all up in our minds, and then we are what we make up. Thought-created reality, our thoughts, are our best guess about what's going on. So the mind takes the input, what's coming in, and then it comes up with a story about the way things are. But the problem is that the mind's a little bit lazy. It likes to cut corners. It likes to make quick judgments, best guesses, quick decisions. It almost would rather make a quick judgment than actually do the work of making a clear assessment of what's going on. And so what we see is that our thoughts are kind of this churned out series of habitual formations coming from our personal conditioning, our family conditioning, our cultural conditioning, our karmic tendencies, our karmic conditioning. And they just think themselves. Psychologists have estimated that we have 60 or 70,000 thoughts a day, and that 99% of them are the same as we had yesterday. So this thought-based reality, it's an approximation of the way things are. Recently, a few weeks ago, I was teaching in northern New Mexico, and I had done a week of retreat, and then I was going to teach for a week, so I moved into the teacher house. And I was trying to take a nap after lunch, and I had earplugs in to be quiet. And so I'm kind of sleeping, and then at one point I wake up and I hear this, it's almost like a hum through my earplugs, and I think, somebody must be chanting downstairs. I was like, isn't that lovely? It's like a love lullaby. And I kind of went back to sleep. Then I woke up, I took the earplugs out, and it was a chainsaw. And I was so floored. I don't like chainsaws generally, and so I created this one world, right? So there was this input, the humming sound, and my mind kind of flipped through the little charts, and the mind was like, I do remember having this slight thought, like, why would somebody be chanting downstairs? But disregard it. That's what the mind does, throws out what isn't consistent with the plan we've come up with. And so I created this whole lovely world where I got to continue napping. But if I'd known that that was a chainsaw, think of the world. It would have been a different world I would have created. It would have been the end of my nap. I would have been angry, like, why are they using a chainsaw when I'm trying to take a nap? I have to teach, I need to be rested, a lot of aversion would have arisen. On retreat, we do this all the time. We call it yogi mind. It gets like exaggerated, like something will get some input and the mind just goes crazy making up a story about what's happening. And then we're totally sure it's right. I would say the biggest yogi mind attack I had on retreat was a number of years ago. This was, well, maybe 20 years ago, maybe longer. And I was on the 3-month retreat, and my ex-boyfriend was on retreat too. We'd broken up like 8 months before, and I was still sore about it. It was a hard breakup for me. But mostly, you know, just ignored him and did my retreat. But one time I walked by the bulletin board, and there's a note in his handwriting to this woman that I suspected he was getting involved with or interested in. Well, my mind went crazy, right? All these stories. Oh, he's getting involved with her. He's contacting her. What's wrong with me? I'm not lovable. I'm going to be alone the rest of my life. And, you know, it was a whole series of thoughts and this world I created and emotions, and it was very painful. In some ways, it was great because I was so motivated to be mindful because I was so much in pain. And so I started to see that kind of like the series of conditioning. So there'd be the thought of the note, the seeing the picture of the note in my mind, and a certain, like the series of thoughts and emotions became very predictable. It would go do, do, do. And after about a week, it took a while, but of really being mindful of thoughts and emotions related to it, it happened really fast. It would be like image, and then done. It was fascinating. It was like, because it was no longer sticky, right? So it would just go through the series. But that's not why I'm telling you the story. So after the retreat, I go up to my ex, and I'm like, what about that note that you wrote to her on the bulletin board? And he looks at me, and he said, I didn't write any notes this retreat. I had made the whole entire thing up. I spent a week believing that reality, right? And it actually, not writing notes fits him better than writing notes, so I believed him because he's not the note-writing type. We make it all up. So we get caught in these worlds, thought-based reality. We make up life as we want it to be. We strategize, we freeze reality, we try to make sense of reality, and we try to freeze it so that we can control it and manipulate it and get what we want. Useful for survival. And yet, there's a way that we find that we get imprisoned, you know, in our own thought worlds. They are a kind of prison. There's a way that we get trapped, right, by our own thoughts. And so what's the alternative? So when I talk about thoughts like this, it's important that we don't start to oppose thought and make thought bad. It's a natural part of being human. It's useful at times. And yet, it's important to understand that there's another way that we can live, and there's another way that we can develop understanding that isn't through our conceptual mind. It's not through our thoughts. And so this would be sense-based reality. That with sense-based reality, we actually come closer to life, closer to experience, more in touch with the way things are, rather than the way we imagine them to be, or create them to be, or want them to be, or strategize them to be in our minds, but actually the way things are. So sense-based reality is this connection to life through our sense experience, through embodiment, through our embodied experience of being human. So through hearing, through smelling, through tasting, through sensing in the body, through seeing. And there is a way of directly experiencing the mind, which is the sixth sense, as Greg, I think, mentioned the other day. So the sense-based reality is the feeling or the heaviness of the buttocks on the cushion and the vibration, the hearing of my voice. It's the seeing of form and color. Purple flowers. One time Suzuki Roshi was asked a rather complicated question about consciousness, and he said, "Oh, I don't know anything about consciousness. I'm just trying to teach my students to hear the birds sing." That's what he was pointing towards, this sense-based reality, this direct connection with life. So I think of this as a kind of waking down, not a waking up, but a waking down into this body, this embodied presence. And it can't be commanded. It has to be approached with patience and gentleness. It makes me think of another story related to thinking. I heard that Pema Chodron one time wound up teaching in Texas, and she was teaching. She said she looked out over the audience, and there were all these men, big men in 10-gallon hats, and she was wondering if they were getting her message of, like, being gentle in your meditation. And then she said years later she was surprised when she was doing a book signing somewhere, and this gentleman came up to her, and he said that he had been one of the participants in this Texas meditation program. And he said that he'd been meditating since her talk, and that at first he was very hard on himself. He'd be very frustrated, and he would catch himself thinking, and he would kind of yell thinking in his mind at himself. And then he said he thought about her instruction, and he decided to take a new approach. And instead of yelling, thinking at himself, when he would find himself thinking, he would bring himself back to the breath by gently saying, "Thinking good, buddy." I love that attitude, "thinking good, buddy." It's like friendly and gentle. You can use it sometime if you find that you're being hard on yourself as far as thinking goes. And so there's this gentleness, right? This gentleness of coming out of the thought-based reality and connecting with the sense-based reality. And so we orient towards our sense experience, towards feeling the body, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting. And I think of it as it's again, it's that farming metaphor. It's more of receiving. We don't, if there's too much aggressiveness and we're trying to too far, too hard, we overshoot. It's actually about relaxing into the body, relaxing into our sense experience. It's like letting it approach us. Words don't quite capture. I'm getting close. I'm getting approximate with the words. This is intimacy. Dogen, the famous Zen master from 12th century, 13th century, around then, he said that awakening is intimacy with all things. So starting this intimacy with our own being sitting here. And so we have these moments, and I'm sure you've had them, these moments of connection with some sense experience, and there's a sense of coming home, of being here fully. And life becomes alive through this connection with our sense experiences, not frozen in the concepts of the mind, but alive. So the difference between, for example, the breath as a thought and the breath as a lived sense experience. So we'll notice at times that if we're being with the breath, that we're actually more with our thought of the breath. Is there a way to relax into, to become intimate with the sensations of breathing? And then we see the breath is much more alive than it is in our thoughts. Or what about the taste of rice? We have the thought, perhaps we know what rice tastes like, but what does it taste like from the beginning to the end of the bite of rice? That's an alive experience. That's an experience that changes. What's a knee pain? So you have an idea of a knee pain, and yet when we get close and intimate, we see that it is swirling perhaps, or changing, or throbbing, or moving, or intensifying, or and waning, or changing to different sensations. That's alive. The thought of a knee pain is frozen. The experience is intimate and alive. And when we can connect with our sense experience like this, then life teaches us the way things are. Life through this embodiment teaches us the way things are. So if there is this sense when we connect with our sense experience. One teacher called it the re-enchantment, that the world becomes enchanted, you could say. It's like living in our concept world, in our thought world, the world gets a little monotone, gets a little dimmed. It's so sure that it knows things that it doesn't really connect. But learning to drop into the immediate experience, there's a kind of enchantment, a kind of aliveness and startlingness. That's not a word. It can be startling. Like perhaps you've had the experience, you're walking in the woods here, and then the leaves, suddenly you really connect with seeing, and the leaves become bright. Enchanting. I was watching the clouds today as I was riding my bike a little bit and looked at the clouds some, and it's like, okay, if I look at the clouds with my idea of the clouds, they look like clouds. But if I look at the clouds with freshness, I noticed that they were mauve and gray underneath. There was this pale mauve color. Don't know how it got there, but it was beautiful. And it was richer because of the connection. When I a number of years ago, I worked as a therapist, and because I speak Spanish, I was working mostly with Puerto Ricans. And one time, one of the women I was working with was fairly new to the country. And she was talking with me, and then she looked out the window, and she's like, "Rebecca, there's this beautiful bird out there." And I love birds. So I went and I looked, and I was like, "Oh, that's just a blue jay." And then I really thought about it. It was so interesting to me because I didn't see the bird, right? I saw my idea of the bird, and my idea of the bird was a blue jay. They're common. But ever since then, like, I look at blue jays. Blue jays are amazing. They're beautiful. She saw the blue jay because she didn't have that, she hadn't yet, her perception hadn't yet been deadened by placing this bird in some kind of conceptual category. It was enchanting to her because she was seeing it freshly. But more importantly, this connection with our sense-based reality, our senses, our embodied experience, connects us, as I said earlier, with the truth of the way things are. So thought likes to fixate reality. Thought likes to make it fixated so we can control it, so we know what to do with it. Another time I was meditating and I heard this sound in the distance. It was like, "Maw, maw." So I'm like, "What's that sound?" And I'm like, "I think it's cows." I was like, "Oh, I like cows. Yeah, it's nice there's cows in the background while I'm meditating, right?" And then I was like, "Maw, maw." I was like, "No, I think it's chainsaws." I was in the Northwest. And I'm like, "I don't like chainsaws," as I have already told you. And I was like, "Is it a cow? Is it a chainsaw?" And I watched my mind. It so wanted to know which it was. It wanted to create some world so that I had a grip on it, right? I could know whether to hate it or like it. We love thinking. And partly we love it because it gives us a sense of control. It gives us a sense of mastery of the moment. You know, so sometimes you're sitting there and you're kind of minding your own business, and then you can see, like, "Oh, I just want to think. Oh, I want to think. I so want to think." It's not bad. Sometimes I think we need, I call them thought vacations. Sometimes we kind of need a thought vacation because reality's too intense. Reality's really intense. So thoughts are like our way to just take a break. It's okay. We can do it. Because landing in sense-based reality, we start to see the truth of the way things are. And part of that truth, for example, is how quickly everything changes, how fleeting the moment is. This basic core truth about reality of change, continuous, ceaseless, rapid change. And related, uncontrollability. When we get in touch with our sense-based reality, we see that there's a lot of life that we can't control. I'm not saying we don't have agency, obviously we do, but it's all changing pretty quickly. So lost in the stories in our heads, we can maintain the illusion, perhaps, of control, or the illusion. Actually, grasping and aversion are just control strategies. So we maintain the delusion of control or the delusion of permanence. And yet when we get here and we're seeing what's happening, it's all passing, arising and passing, arising and passing, arising and passing. And there's a sense of groundlessness. And we're like, get me back to some good thought. Get me back to something I can hang on to. So we start, when we are in touch with the senses, we start to see the truths of anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three characteristics of existence, change, unsatisfactoriness. We start to see that if we try to hang on to anything in this sense-based world and rely on it for a refuge, it's not going to satisfy because it will change. And we see this directly. We don't see it as thought, but we see it moment to moment to moment, and that's what transforms. Sometimes we hope that we can think out our liberation, right? But actually we live out our liberation. So sometimes we'll find ourselves thinking Dharma thoughts. I label them Dharma thoughts. So we get on a good string of thinking about the Dharma and how it comes together. And give it up. Life teaches us through our direct experience. So that's what we're aiming for with the mindfulness, with the waking up, with the presence, is coming back to experience and letting life teach us. We're used to the refuge of the conceptual mind. And it takes trust and it takes courage to make this shift. And yet we have these moments, right? We just keep practicing moment by moment, coming back, waking up out of the thought-created worlds, coming back to something present here, now, the sense experience. So we risk touching life directly and letting life touch us. So it's a two-way street, you could say. It's this softening and melting the sense of separation, the barriers to being touched by life. Enjoying this direct, unmediated experience of reality through our own body sense experience. Melting those barriers in the heart and the mind that separate us from reality. I'd like to read a poem by a poet of European descent, Robert Penn Warren, called Ornithology in a World of Flux. It was only a bird call at evening, unidentified, as I came from the spring with water across the rocky back pasture. But so still I stood, sky above was not stiller than sky in pale water. Years pass, all places and faces fade, some people have died, and I stand in a far land, the evening still, and am at last sure that I miss more that stillness at bird call than some things that were to fail later. That piercing of separation in that moment, what we long for, that deep connection. Or lack of barriers between us and life. Please don't make an enemy out of thoughts. They are also our friends. And yet know that we have an alternative. We have an alternative way of knowing. We have an alternative way of working out our freedom through this contact with the sense experience of being human, the sense experience of this human body. And we've given the mind its time. So we can practice letting the thought worlds go, letting them fade. And emphasizing these increasing moments of contact with our sense experience. The breath, the body sitting, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting. And this kind of softening, you could say, of the cognitive cocoon that attempts to protect us from this groundlessness of being, from the true nature of life. As we soften this cognitive cocoon, we get in touch with a kind of trust. A trust in something that's hard to name, but something that we sense in this connection. Something we sense perhaps in the feeling of the brisk autumn air on our cheeks, or the sound of the creaking floorboards, or the beautiful mauve undertones of the clouds, or the call of a bird across the meadow. And there's this kind of homecoming. Unification, a melting of the barriers that imprison us in separation, being touched by life, letting life touch us. There's a poem by Native American poet Joey Harjo, that ego poem that maybe gets a little bit of the sense of this. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you. And know there's more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know, except in moments steadily growing and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circles in blue sky and wind swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion, like eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. Let's sit for a minute. If anything resonated, letting that be with you, and then letting the words float away. Coming back to sense-based reality of our bodies, sitting, sensing, hearing, resting in reality.